If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
I feel quite comfortable about using the phrase ethnic cleansing with regard to what happened to the German civilian population in Great Britain.
That was Panikos Panayi discussing German internees in Britain during the First World War.
The key question here is, actually, what is the role of sea power in shaping history? What actually happened here? Why were we fighting the French at San Domingo in 1806, so shortly after the Battle of Trafalgar?
And that was Sam Willis on first-hand accounts from Nelson's Navy. Hello, and welcome to the History Extra podcast. My name is Rob Attar, and I'm the editor of BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. You can find it in all good newsagents and on subscription. We also have digital editions available for the iPad, the Kindle Fire, and Google Play. And we've now set up a page on our website with details of all our digital formats, including the price, content, and availability. Head to historyextra.com/digital for that. And also on historyextra.com you can find our latest subscription deals for the print magazine. During the First World War, hundreds of thousands of Germans, both civilians and soldiers, were incarcerated in Britain. Their experiences are now the subject of a book by Panikos Panayi, a historian at De Montfort University. I spoke to him recently about his research into this little-known story. How many Germans were interred in Britain during the First World War?
It depends whether you count civilians and military. I mean, if we're talking about civilians, then it's something over 30,000, let's say 30 to 32,000. And then if you include military prisoners, then it goes over 100,000. So, you know, it depends how you're counting them.
Were they interred in the same kind of way?
Yes, they were. I mean, they when the war first broke out, there was a whole series of government departments that were responsible for internment. And initially, there wasn't a clear-cut policy. So you had both civilians and military prisoners who were interned in the same camps. But as the war progressed, especially after 1915, 1916, the two types of prisoners were separated. They had different rules under the Geneva Convention, for example. Civilians couldn't work. But essentially, the camps that they found themselves in, the two different groups, were fairly similar.
How would a civilian end up being a prisoner? Would it just have been a German living in Britain, or would they have had to show some kind of affiliation with the German country?
Well, that's quite an interesting question. I mean, you can divide the civilians into, I guess, three main categories. The first category would be those civilians who were long-term residents of Great Britain. So, you know, there'd been migration from Germany to Britain throughout the Victorian period. So the census figure for 1911 says there's 53,324 unnaturalized Germans. The other issue is that their internment in World War One only affects males, except two or three females who are regarded as being, you know, dangerous to the realm. So of those just over 53,000, those of military age would have faced internment. Those who had become naturalized wouldn't face internment. And the way it works is that government policy evolved over the course of the war. And basically, the decision to introduce wholesale internment was reached in May 1915, following the sinking of the Lusitania. And that's when internment of civilians peaked. However, to those, you also need to add some Germans were sort of spending time in the summer of 1914 in Great Britain. So two classic studies, one by Paul Cohen Portheim, who wrote his account of internment. He was basically painting in Great Britain in the summer of 1914, and eventually ended up in an internment camp in Wakefield and spent several years there. And also another account of an individual who was learning English in Bexhill-on-Sea, and he ended up in the Isle of Man. So we've got the long-term residents, those who were just passing through, and then what the British Empire did. I mean, in a sense, I think we need to view internment as a global imperial experience. So what the British Navy did was that if you're unfortunate enough to be sailing from North America to Europe just after the war broke out in August 1914, the British Navy tended to stop ships, whether they're German or not, and take German residents off, bring them to Great Britain, and then they could spend years in internment camps. And connected to that is people were brought from British and German colonies to face internment in Great Britain. So I guess that's four categories in a sense, rather than three categories. So it is a sort of, you know, almost global system, because you didn't have to live in Great Britain to find yourself interned within Great Britain.
Was there any ethical objection to the internment of Germans who are only civilians?
There was very little opposition to internment in Great Britain during the First World War. In the Second World War, internment lasted for only about a year or so for the vast majority of people. In the First World War, Great Britain was just completely saturated with a sort of Germanophobic discourse. And it sort of drowned out virtually all voices of opposition. I mean, there are voices of opposition, but they're in a tiny minority. So it will be, newspapers or magazines such as the New Statesman. But I mean, it's almost absent. The other group which sort of objects to internment, well, not necessarily objects, but helps internees and their families, is the Society of Friends. But I mean, it is if I was going to do it in percentage terms, it seems almost as if there's a 95% for internment and a 5% against. I mean, if you gauge public opinion in the normal way, you gauge public opinion through, you know, Commons debates or newspapers and so on. So, I mean, it's an overwhelming support for internment.
What would happen, for example, if there was a German living in Britain who was married to a British woman? Could they still be interned? And would their wife then have to go with them?
The German could certainly become interned. I mean, whether he's married to an English woman or not would be irrelevant. And the British woman would have to rely on charitable or government support or work. I mean, even worse than that is you do have cases of people who were born in Germany, i.e. still have German citizenship, who will find themselves interned on the Isle of Man while their sons are fighting for the British Army on the Western Front. So, you know, it's a very complex process and one which sort of, I don't know, artificially divides families.
You said there were quite a large number of German military internees. How would they have been transported to Britain from the front?
Well, the stories we have, I mean, the overwhelming majority of them are basically captured in France. And in the middle of the war, there's a decision reached, sort of during the course of 1916, that they could be used in Great Britain to carry out labour and essentially in agriculture, although they do work in other areas as well. So, I mean, there's not that many narratives about the journey, but I mean, you know, they're basically, you know, transported to Calais or Le Havre, then taken by boat to a south coast port, Portsmouth or Southampton. And then they sort of spend a few days in one of these transit camps on the south coast. And then eventually, you know, they're taken inland to one of the larger camps, such as Pattisall in Northampton or Dorchester, which was a very long lasting camp, or even to Stobs in Scotland. And, you know, and that's the sort of way that the process works. I mean, there are within military, we probably also need to recognize some prisoners from the German Navy, although, you know, we're probably talking about a few thousand, and also even a few Zeppelins that fell to earth, but, you know, they're a handful. Sorry, and in addition to the naval prisoners, there's also submarine prisoners, and they were treated worse than other prisoners because of the furore over the U-boat campaign and unrestricted submarine warfare. Although, that was a short-term thing, and eventually they had the same conditions as all other military prisoners.
So coming on to those conditions, what would it have been like for the Germans living in these camps? What kind of accommodation was it?
One always has to come to the conclusion that the conditions within these camps were, well, good, I guess, is actually the word I would use. I mean, if you look at some of the civilian diaries or some of the civilian memoirs or accounts of internment, some of them feel incredibly bitter about internment. And the classic account is Paul Cohen, Paul Time. He was an Austro-Hungarian, actually, who wrote this wonderful book, Time Stood Still. And his complaint was, he was completely bored, because under the Geneva Convention, you're not supposed to work. But having said that, you know, the Swiss embassy and the US embassy, until it entered the war, had responsibility for conditions within the camps, you know, because of diplomatic relations being broken off between Britain and Germany. So initially the USA and then Switzerland was the go-between. And these two governments or their embassies in London carried out inspections, well, very regularly, of virtually every single camp that was established in Great Britain. And, you know, they're all available in the German National Archives and the National Archives of Britain in Kew. And if you read these, I mean, you know, there's constant complaining by POWs or internees. Well, actually, it's mostly civilian internees rather than military prisoners of war, because military prisoners of war, in a sense, being in an internment camp was a relief from fighting on the Western Front. Whereas for many civilian internees, the internment, that was their great war experience, and many of them bitterly resented it. But, you know, going back to the issue of conditions, I mean, the conditions were no worse than they probably would have been for any other male combatant, involved anywhere in Europe in the First World War. In fact, you know, if you're just looking at it from a rational point of view, were conditions bad? Actually, no, the material conditions were you know, satisfactory for sure.
The kind of work that the prisoners of war had to do, what would that involve, and was it particularly tough on them?
Well, the government, the British government, was particularly concerned about the harvest from 1916 to onwards. So, I mean, the military prisoners of war did all sorts of, you know, agricultural work, especially, you know, as I've just said, harvesting. So, you know, if they were involved in heavy work, they could actually obtain extra rations. And also, people, you know, the ones who aren't involved in agriculture are involved in all sorts of other things, engineering, road laying, and so on. So, you know, it's quite a variety of tasks that they're involved in.
What was the reaction of the British people that encountered them, whether they were in the camps or in the local area? How did they respond to the German prisoners?
That's quite interesting, because I suppose I'll have to contradict myself about public opinion, the point I made earlier on, because actually when real people, if you like, came into contact with especially military prisoners of war, they were actually quite positive towards them. And you do have examples of, you know, people giving the military prisoners food if they happened to meet them, you know, while they were harvesting or carrying out any other work. And there, I mean, you know, there is examples of letters being exchanged between military prisoners and you know, local women, which and some of these actually end up in court, especially those individuals who give the POWs food. You also have one or two examples of escapees who are sort of, well, maybe not, I guess sheltered in the homes of local residents. So that happens on especially one occasion on the Isle of Man, where both the woman who's sheltering the prisoner and the husband are sort of taken to court about this. So despite the sort of rampant Germanophobia, ordinary people come into contact with POWs, the hostility doesn't come across in the same way. Although, again, I'll have to qualify that by pointing out that one of the backgrounds to civilian internment is the mass rioting of May 1915. And when Asquith introduced rioting in May 1915, the Prime Minister, it was basically one of the reasons he gave was to protect the German population. So, you know, I mean, it's still overwhelmingly negative, but the attitude towards Germans, but you know, there are certainly individual examples of kindness, one could say.
Why do you think it was that the attitude seemed to be quite different to prisoners of war than towards Germany and Germans in general?
Well, I think it's just, well, I think it's the human contact. I mean, that would be the only explanation you can use. You know, you can have the propaganda, the posters, you know, the newspapers constantly beating the anti-German drum. But, you know, when you come across Germans on the ground, then, you know, you realize they're just the same as you. I mean, I guess in a sense, that's how all you know, prejudice works. It's just broken down when you have contact with the person who, you know, your rulers, if you like, are telling you to be prejudiced towards. So, you know, I think it's the human contact.
And you mentioned earlier about an escapee. Were escapes quite common from these prisoner of war camps?
Yeah, they were incredibly common. I mean, in my book, I've got a chapter called Escape, Release and Return. And I would say hundreds escaped. I mean, I speculate whether it might even be thousands, but I mean, certainly we can say that there were hundreds of escapees. And sometimes if you read the newspapers, at some moments, I think there was one moment in time in 1916 or 17 where there was something like 23 different people on the run. But I mean, what happens is that they're always caught, except there's only three occasions where someone actually makes it back to Germany. And with the civilians, most of the civilians are interned on the Isle of Man. So not only do they have to get off the Isle of Man, they then have to cross the Channel. And that, I mean, actually none of them, as far as I've discovered, even got off the Isle of Man. So the ones that escaped and made it back to Germany all escaped from the mainland. And one of them, Gunter Plushov, his account, amazingly, is still in print, you know, almost 100 years later. But I mean, it's sort of the, you know, it's an escape yarn. He weaves a wonderful tale, which is why that story's still in print. So while escape is extremely common, capture is almost just as common.
Why did you think it was so easy for them to escape? Was the security not particularly strong?
Well, the Plushoff account that I've mentioned, I mean, he sort of, well, his story suggests that it was, but you know, that while he was in Donington Hall, that's where he escaped from. He's, you know, used to keep watching the guards, and, you know, watched when they would, what, you know, their individual movements, and then he made his plan. And another account, you know, again, suggests meticulous planning. But I mean, you know, the fact that so many, I mean, I don't think all of them, I mean, these two accounts are people who actually succeeded. So, I mean, all the camps had guards. I mean, I suspect also, you know, the people who are involved in working in the countryside, I mean, escapes quite straightforward there. So, you know, there is security, probably not as obsessive, if you like, as it is in the contemporary world. So, you know, I think it's a combination of factors which allows people to escape.
When the war is over, what happened to all these prisoners?
Well, if we deal with the civilians and then the military prisoners, the civilians are basically deported. I mean, it's a quite a ruthless process. I mean, I studied this subject in the actually in the late 80s, and I use the phrase deportation. I mean, since I've come back to it, you know, I mean, my initial research was on Germans in Britain in World War One. Now I've moved on to this specific focus on internment. And in the meantime, we've had the development of this phrase ethnic cleansing. And I mean, I feel quite comfortable about using the phrase ethnic cleansing with regard to what happened to the German civilian population in Great Britain, because, you know, you have in 1911 we have 53,000 Germans. At the end of the war, in the early 1920s, we have 20,000. And what's happened to the other 30,000 is that they've been deported. I mean, you can appeal against deportation, so, you know, there is some sort of judicial safety net, if you like. People do appeal and are successful, but, you know, the overwhelming majority of Germans, German civilians, are deported. And amongst those are also, of course, their children and their English-born wives. So if you're an English-born wife, not only are you deported from, you know, your homeland, if you like, you then move to a country which has just been at war with your homeland for over 4 years. So, you know, it's quite an unpleasant experience for them in particular. And with the military prisoners, I mean, they're sort of returned, you know, as POWs are. But I mean, again, as part of the vindictiveness of Versailles, all the Allied prisoners have to be returned first, and then the German prisoners are returned subsequently. So most of the return of the military prisoners is quite a gradual process and isn't completed until the end of 1919.
How did the British government justify deporting all these German civilians who hadn't actually committed any crime or fought against Britain?
Well, it was just the level of Germanophobia in Britain at the end of the First World War. I mean, the way you have to understand it is that, you know, this deportation has happened at the end of a process in which the German community has had all its property confiscated. So you know, from the Deutsche Bank to the local German butcher or baker, all that property is confiscated without compensation. And even worse, all that property is then forms part of the German reparations payment. So, you know, you have that, and you also have the rioting. You've had the deportation, actually, has been ongoing throughout the whole course of the war. And there was this whole series of regulations introduced against Germans during the First World War. Not only had all their businesses been closed, but all their clubs had been closed, all their newspapers had been closed. I mean, it's a sort of dehumanizing of the Germans. I mean, you know, some scholars talk about the racialization of the Germans. And, you know, after the sinking of the Lusitania, one newspaper called for the extermination of all Germans in Great Britain. So, you know, it's a complete dehumanization of Germans. I mean, it feeds in from the Germanophobia towards the German nation. But I mean, making the link between the German nation and its representatives in Great Britain is easy. You know, I mean, they're the same in the discourse we have. And even during one of the famous slogans from the Kharkiv election at the end of 1918 was we'll squeeze the Germans till the pips squeak. And, you know, that's the background against which all this happened. I mean, you know, it's it peaks during the war, but I mean, it sort of lasts into the early post-war period.
I know your research is focused on the German prisoners in Britain, but do we have any idea of how their treatment compared with British prisoners in Germany?
There was a lot of, you know, British media discourse about how badly the British prisoners are treated in Germany. And I mean, I think I'd have to believe, you know, that the British in Germany are treated worse within internment camps. I mean, if we're dealing with the civilian population as a whole, it's probably very similar within the camps. I think probably the British in Germany were treated worse than the Germans in Britain. Although I think, you know, one of my colleagues who's looked at Ruhleben, Matthew Stibber, the classic symbol of internment of Britons in Germany, it was just outside Berlin, has suggested actually the way you have to understand this is the relative material conditions of, or one of the ways you have to understand it is the relative material conditions of Germans during the Great War compared with Britons during the Great War. So if conditions were worse for British prisoners, they're also worse for the German civilian population as a whole. So that's one of the explanations I think we'd have to offer for that.
And I guess the other obvious comparison would be with the Second World War. How did the treatment of Germans in that war compare with the First World War?
Well, it's quite different. Great Britain in World War II sort of never became so obsessively Germanophobic in the way that it did in World War I. And I mean, there's a whole series of reasons for that. But I mean, if we just concentrate on the Germans in Britain in World War I and the Germans in Britain in World War II, the Germans in Britain in World War II were overwhelmingly refugees from the Nazis. So if you're fighting an anti-Nazi war, you can't really intern opponents or victims of the Nazis. So internment is introduced as a panic measure after the spring offensive and the Italian declaration of war on Great Britain. So it affects Italians as well in the spring of 1940. In the same way in which it's introduced in May 1915, after the sinking of the Lusitania. The difference is that internment in World War I goes from May 1915 until the very end of the war. In World War II, it lasts for most people a year at most. And, you know, we'd have to understand that against the background of, you know, what I said previously, if you're fighting an anti-Nazi war, you can't intern the victims or the opponents of Nazism. But somehow in World War II, the government and public opinion saw sense, whereas in World War I, it didn't. I mean, you know, most of these people interned in World War I, well, had limited connections with the country from which they came. And in some cases, when they're deported in 1919, they're going back home after decades. And I mean, one case I read, the man who's deported ends up living, you know, as an adult in his 40s or 50s with his sister, because that's, you know, he's got absolutely nothing within Germany.
And you talk about the camps that people were interned at the time. Are any of them still around today?
I guess the most famous one is Alexandra Palace in North London. And, you know, that's still there. You know, you can see the rooms where people were interned. I mean, you know, you wouldn't know it, although there is a plaque side of Alexandra Palace to say this was an internment camp in World War One. The very famous one is Nocalo on the Isle of Man. And this was probably one of the biggest internment camps anywhere in the First World War, certainly in the British Empire. And this lasts from November 1914 until the end of 1919. And I mean, I've just visited it because one of the things I hope to do is establish a memorial just to commemorate it as an internment camp. And all you have is a field, and then you have a shield, essentially, along the main road put up by the Isle of Man government. You know, it's probably about 3 or 4 foot square, acknowledging this was an internment camp. And then if you go into the grounds, there's a group called the Anglo-German Family History Society who have put up another plaque. But basically, there's little trace of what happened. You know, something like 30,000 men passed through this camp during the Great War. But, you know, if you went to the Island Man and you drove past it, you'd have no idea. So, you know, in most cases, there's little trace or no trace at all about, you know, there's over 600 camps that are existing in Great Britain during the course of the war. I mean, you know, most of them are very small, but they've sort of disappeared from memory, from British memory.
Why do you think it is that people aren't more interested in this and more recognition hasn't been made of these places?
Well, I think the main explanation I'd offer is, you know, it was just, I keep talking about this Germanophobic hatred and, you know, it is extremely intense. And so, you know, in the same way that this experience is marginalized in World War One, it's also marginalized subsequently, whether in the 20s or after the 20s. I mean, you do have some local historians who now recognize that there are camps, there were camps in their localities. But if you read about this episode, especially the treatment of the civilian internees as a whole is a very unpleasant history. I mean, the treatment of the military prisoners, you know, it's humane. I mean, you'd have to, if you read all the documents, German POWs in Britain were treated well. But I mean, if you put the civilian internment in the context of the treatment of Germans in Britain during the First World War as a whole, then it's sort of, you know, it's a very uncomfortable episode in British history, and, you know, doesn't really fit in with the mainstream stereotypes about tolerant Britain and so on, because, you know, it's an extremely unpleasant episode.
So it's the kind of history that maybe some people don't really want to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's one way of putting it, yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
That was Panikos Panayi, Professor of European History at De Montfort University. His new book is out now and it's titled Prisoners of Britain, German Civilian and Combatant Internees During the First World War, published by Manchester University Press. A book that was discovered in the depths of the British Library features a collection of first-hand reports of sailors from the turn of the 19th century. Naval historian Sam Willis has written an article about these reports for our March issue, and he spoke to our book's editor, Matt Elton, about the collection and what it can tell us about the Golden Age of the Royal Navy.
So how and when did you come across this collection of records?
Well, I came across the dispatches in 2010 when I was doing the research for a book called The Glorious 1st of June, which is about a naval battle which was fought in 1794 between Britain and France. And I knew from the British Library catalogue that there was a letter there from Admiral Howe back to the Admiralty. And so I was expecting just to read a single letter, maybe two or three pages. And this is the moment they wheeled over a massive box the size of a coffin. And inside it was a truly extraordinary collection of dispatches.
And how many documents are we talking all bound up in this box?
In terms of documents, I'm not sure, but there are at least 350 pages.
Wow.
So it's an extraordinary treasure trove. And they include the main admiral's dispatch, the main admiral's narrative of the battle in which he's been in. Some are incredibly short, some are very long. It includes descriptions of the battles which have been sent by his captains. It includes the bosun's damage reports. It includes surgeons' reports of injuries received by men. It includes captured narratives, maps, charts. It just goes on and on. It's an absolute treasure trove.
And what dates does it cover?
The battles run from 1794 till 1806. The ones that have been collected here are the most significant British fleet victories of the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. It's an interesting chunk of history because it is not at the beginning of the French Revolutionary War, and it certainly is not at the end, because the end was in 1815 when we finally defeated Napoleon. So the collection starts, say, 2 years after the beginning of the French Revolutionary Wars, and it finishes a full 9 years before they end. But it was in this period where the British military dominance was such that it equaled any in history. It was an extraordinary period.
It seems kind of strange that such a kind of extensive and valuable collection could have been, you know, unexplored for so long. Were you surprised that this was the case?
I was enormously surprised. The majority of British naval records are actually kept in the National Archives in Kew, and there are millions of naval records there. There are letters from captains to the Admiralty, from the Admiralty to captains. There are logbooks. There's a whole variety that goes back to the Navy of Henry VIII. Now, these letters have been removed from that collection, and when this body of dispatches was created in 1821. And so any naval historian would actually go to the National Archives in expectation of finding these letters, but they're not there. And there's nothing there that says that they're not there. And so I think that's one of the reasons explaining why so many scholars have missed this collection.
And they genuinely have been missed, like people didn't know that they were all there to this extent.
I found a handful of references to them in the past 60 or 70 years of scholarship. Something like five people have mentioned them in published works. What's really interesting is that if you look at the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, there it has the kind of the official short biography of all of these admirals among all of the main figures of English history. And it also lists the sources of their letters, their archives. And none of the admirals that are mentioned in dispatches have this collection of dispatches noted as a source for their work, which is a terrible shame, because it was in the aftermath of battle where you can see the personality of these people so clearly.
It's incredible. So you touched on there the kinds of record, well, the kinds of information that's available through these records. What can we learn from them?
The records are all of different types. The narratives generally describe what happened, but what's interesting is often what has been excluded from the description as much as been what has been included. We learn about the event that they describe. We learn about the character of the admiral in person. What's amazing is the variety of material that you get within these dispatches. And they cover seven different battles, and every battle was commanded by a different admiral. The only one where it slightly crosses over is the Battle of the Nile in 1798, when Nelson defeated the fleet of Napoleon, and the Battle of Trafalgar. But Nelson died shortly after the start of the Battle of Trafalgar, so that fleet was actually commanded by Admiral Lord Collingwood. So what we have here is the glorious 1st of June in 1794 with Admiral Howe. We have the Battle of Cape St. Vincent in 1797 with John Jervis, the Earl of St. Vincent. At the Battle of Camperdown in the same year with Admiral Duncan. We have the Battle of the Nile in 1798 with Nelson, Copenhagen in 1801 with Hyde Parker, Trafalgar in 1805 with Collingwood, and then the Battle of San Domingo in 1806 with Admiral Duckworth. So you get this incredible variety of the personalities of these admirals.
Talking about the personalities, to what extent do we get a feel for the kinds of men who are writing these letters?
When you read the letters, you get a real sense of their personalities. Some, like Howe and Duckworth, found it very difficult to express themselves in paper. They were very decisive when commanding a fleet, but they really rambled when they were trying to describe something. Others are incisive and quick. Duncan is one of those. He was a man of deeds and not words, and so his dispatch is incredibly brief, and he actually wrote it before the battle had finished. He was saying very much, this is what I am doing rather than this is what I have done. And I think that's a particularly interesting example. The Hyde Parker one from Copenhagen is interesting because of the political manoeuvres that happened before the battle. Nelson's dispatches are very well thought out. He doesn't rush them. He sees it as an opportunity to very much generate support for him, generate support for his career. He's a real wordsmith and a storyteller. So he has sat down, he has taken his time over it. And his dispatch, the Nile dispatch, the copy in this collection, is actually written by a secretary. It's been dictated, which again gives you an impression of a very measured construction.
Something else that also interests me about the collection from your feature is that, as well as the words, there's quite a lot of visual documents. What kind of information do these include?
On the one hand, you have the letters, but also we have these amazing visual documents. We have several maps from the Battle of the Nile, which were attached to a French narrative. And the Frenchman in question had actually written this narrative while in captivity on board a British ship after the battle. There are also a great deal of tables giving casualty figures. The casualty figures are fascinating because they're a real snapshot of a fleet in the aftermath of battle. Almost all of them are inaccurate. We no longer think that the figures given in these letters are what actually happened in the battle. And that's an important lesson, I think, for the letters from the captains and admirals as well. There was so much chaos and confusion in the battle that actually these people who were there were unable to get a rounded grasp on the events that they were describing. And so we have these very sharp sort of shards, these sharp glimpses of history, which are as much blinkered as they are illustrative of what they have seen. Other of this visual material, we have the lines of battle, we have the fates of enemy ships, a whole host of things.
One thing that these letters do allow us to do, which really interested me, is that you get a sense of the personal impact of the war from them. Are there any particular examples that you think bring this home?
One of the ones which is really interesting is a letter after the Battle of Camperdown, which is written by William Bligh. This is the William Bligh from the Mutiny on the Bounty. And he, having been kicked off the Bounty by Fletcher Christian, he survived a 3,500-mile open boat journey. And if anyone knew about discomfort, it was William Bligh. And interestingly, he writes a letter after the battle, and he writes to the Admiralty complaining that his men have lost their beds and their bedding and their hammocks and their clothes and their shoes. Things very personal, things really to do with actual the physical comfort of the sailors who have risked their lives. So it's a particularly interesting document, whoever had written it, but the fact that it was Bligh makes it much more so.
Are there any other characters that particularly stand out from the collection, or you think came across in a different light from how you expected?
One of the captains who fought at the glorious 1st of June was a particularly heroic, adventurous fighter. His name was Thomas Pasley. And actually, his diaries that survive, called the Pasley Sea Journals, are one of the most entertaining collections of letters from the period that you could ever hope to read. He wrote a letter to Admiral Howe in the aftermath of the glorious 1st of June because Howe wanted to know what had happened in different parts of the battle. They were fought over miles and miles of ocean. There was no way that one admiral could actually understand or know what had happened. So Howe asked his captains to write their own personal reports. Howe received all of these reports in the days after the battle, but Pasley's was late. It was 4 or 5 days late. And it was because he'd had a leg amputated, and he refers to it in his letter as my unfortunate situation. But apart from that, he makes no reference at all to the fact that he's had one of his legs cut off. It's a letter that he has dictated to a secretary, and he can barely hold a quill to sign his name at the foot of it. It's a shaky, wobbly signature. But the language is full of wonderful Pasleian flourishes, celebrating the heroism of his men and the heroism of the other captains that he witnessed. It's a letter of extraordinary courage, and his loss was a terrible blow to the Royal Navy. One of the things that really comes across is how different the admirals were. They were certainly not carbon copies of each other. They were of different ages. Nelson was incredibly young when he fought at the Nile. Howe was very old when he fought at the glorious 1st of June. And they all dealt with the trauma of battle in different ways. They all dealt with the tasks of writing to the Admiralty in different ways. And so we don't see the Navy kind of churning out the same type of admiral throughout these years. And in fact, what is most striking about it is the extraordinary variety of the people that reached this high rank.
Were there any aspects of the period that the collection made you reconsider?
One of the things that this collection really makes you think about is the relationship between the flag officers and their captains. And this is related to their different personalities. So you could be a captain serving one day under Jarvis, and then a year later you could be serving under Duckworth. And you get a real sense of intense friendship, but also of major personality clashes as well, which you'd always get in fleets. But they do really come across in these dispatches, often in the gaps, which is really interesting. Why did Howe not thank some of his captains after the glorious 1st of June? Why did Nelson not name his second in command after the Battle of the Nile? Why was Duckworth not even speaking to his second in command at the Battle of San Domingo? And these are issues that all come out in the dispatches. You have to know where to look sometimes, but they're all there.
We've talked a lot about the personal relationships between people. Do these letters throw a new light on the kind of wider kind of naval picture of the period?
One of the really interesting questions that these dispatches raise is illustrated by the dates in which they cover. So we have these battles from 1794 to 1806. These are extraordinary repeated fleet victories. We beat the French, the revolutionary French in 1794, the Spanish in 1797, the Dutch again in the same year, the Napoleonic French in 1798, the Danes in 1801, the French and the Spanish in 1805, and then the French again in 1806. So we're winning these massive fleet victories, but then we're having to fight again and again and again and again. And then the last battle is in 1806. That's 9 years before the war ended. So the key question here is actually, what is the role of sea power in shaping history? What actually happened here? Why were we fighting the French at San Domingo in 1806, so shortly after the Battle of Trafalgar? Everyone thinks that the British won total control of the sea after the Battle of Trafalgar, but of course that's nonsense. We didn't do anything like that at all. Two entire fleets didn't fight. French fleets didn't fight at Trafalgar, so we had to deal with those in the immediate aftermath. So it's locating these series of battles within the broader narrative of the history of the war that really makes you question the impact of sea power on shaping history.
Do you have a favourite letter from the collection or a couple of favourites?
Well, my favourite letter in the collection is from Collingwood to a Spanish admiral called Alava in the aftermath of Trafalgar. He's been in shock, basically. He's a bit of a wreck after the battle, and he's trying to find out what had happened. He's trying to assess the scale of his victory. And he hears that one Spanish flag officer, Alava, had actually surrendered. And he then discovers that Alava's actually in Cadiz. Alava's legged it. He's gone home. He's having a lovely time at Cadiz. So Collingwood writes this brilliant letter saying, dear sir, I'm delighted to hear you are having a nice recuperation and your wound is not too bad and you're in Cadiz. But actually, you surrendered yourself for me and I would like to consider yourself, you to consider yourself as a prisoner of war. And Alava replies, unsurprisingly disagreeing with him. He says, no, I didn't surrender at all. I'm fine and I'm not going to come and be your prisoner. Now, Collingwood reacted to this in a really interesting way. He was an incredibly gifted diplomat, Collingwood, and not many people recognise that. He realised the precarious situation that the Spanish held in relation to their allies, the French. And Collingwood didn't press it. He didn't say, actually, you did surrender and you are going to be my prisoner. He sent him a big bag of fruit and some cheese as a present. And Alava sent Collingwood back some port and some other goodies. And we think that this was actually a key moment in the changing relationship between Britain and Spain, who were enemies at Trafalgar. But in 1807, 2 years later, the Spanish switched sides. And that was absolutely crucial to the way that the Napoleonic Wars actually ended.
And finally, I suppose, what's going to happen to the collection now? Are there any plans for its future?
The British Library have been hugely enthusiastic about the discovery. And we are now talking to them about different ways in which we can make the collection as broadly accessible as possible, because we need to remember that that was the purpose that these dispatches were gathered together. They weren't randomly put together. They were given as a gift from the Lords of the Admiralty to the nation in the year that Napoleon died in exile in 1821. It was a way of looking back on this period of extraordinary victory and saying, these are the lessons of sea power. This is how we carved out our empire. This is how we won peace. And the fact that it was a gift and that it was created to be shared, to be seen as an educational and as an inspirational tool, is crucial to its identity. And I think we really need to move forward and to make sure that as many people as possible get to see this collection of dispatches.
That was Sam Willis. Sam is the author of In the Hour of Victory, The Royal Navy at War in the Age of Nelson, which has recently been published by Atlantic. You can read an article by Sam in the March issue of BBC History magazine, which is on sale now. Also in this edition, we've got articles on Henry V, Thomas Cromwell, Egyptology, and the Richard III debate. You can get hold of it in all good newsagents and digitally. If you visit historyextra.com/digital, you can find information on our digital editions. And that's almost all for this week. Do let us know what you think on email. We're podcast@historyextra.com. You can follow us on Twitter @HistoryExtra or head to facebook.com/HistoryExtra. Next week, we'll be talking about two titans of English history, Henry V and Thomas Cromwell. Do join us for that. And in the meantime, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you can find quizzes, podcasts, blogs and more. The History Extra weekly podcast was recorded in Bristol and produced by Jack Fletcher.